I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root Artist feature. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with visual artist Larry Walker. Mr. Walker, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you for having some time to spend with me today for this conversation. First of all, I'm very curious about your early beginnings in Franklin, Georgia. So what do you recall most about your early days in Georgia?
That's interesting because how did you know I was born in Franklin, Georgia? At any rate, Franklin, Georgia, I don't know anything about. When I was very, very young, the family moved from Franklin to LaGrange. And the reason for that move was at that point in time, we were in Franklin, we were sharecropping. My father died when I was 6 months old, so I never knew him. I'm the youngest of 11. And so, you know, the age difference with my brothers and sisters was tremendous. So we were sharecropping, and the house burned down. Completely burned down to the ground. So we had to relocate, and we moved to LaGrange and lived for a short period of time with my oldest brother, who was married, and so forth. And until my mom was able to find another place for us in LaGrange, just a few miles away from where my brother lived. So we were in LaGrange until we moved to New York. And when we moved to New York, I was 6 years old. So my memories of Georgia are sketchy, you know, between the ages of 2 and 6, a little of this, a little of that, right. But nothing major.
Well, going from LaGrange, Georgia to New York City, obviously, big change.
Big change. In fact, when we moved to from LaGrange, it was the first time I was on the train. It was like gawking at everything. And back in those days, you had to carry your lunch and stuff with you and picnic baskets and, you know, fried chicken in picnic baskets. After a while, the odor of fried chicken just permeates the whole area. And I never enjoyed a train ride since then. But we arrived in New York and got off the train and almost immediately got into another kind of train, which was a subway.
Right.
And after we got off the subway at 145th Street and Lenox Avenue.
Harlem.
Walked upstairs, and I was looking up at all of the tall buildings, gawking at these buildings. I said, my goodness, we were in heaven. We've moved from this rural kind of area to heaven. And the buildings were just magnificent, and there were so many people all over the place. We walked from Lenox Avenue down the street, about halfway down the block, to 137 was the number of the building. And then we walked up the stairs, six-story tenement. Walked up six stories. So that was my life for a long period of time, from age 6 to 17, up and down those stairs.
The same place?
Same place.
Okay.
Up and down those stairs. And it was no problem then, because I was young, didn't know any better. In fact, everybody I knew in the area was young and didn't know much better. And it was like, we didn't realize we were poor. It was like, this is the way things are, you know? Had the one event that would be significant from my perspective is that my mother was working, and she was concerned about the younger kids, myself, my sister, who was three years older than me. She wanted us to come home from school and stay in the house until she got home from work. Didn't want us out in the street because there was too much other stuff going on. At that time, there was probably a gang in practically every block in New York, in Harlem. And she didn't want us getting involved in anything that we shouldn't be involved in. So by staying inside, I had developed other kind of activities. Drawing, looking out the window and drawing buildings and drawing clotheslines from one building to the next on the back side of the house, and creating a little game on an old, card table. I created a baseball diamond and played baseball with my fingers. Hit the ball, run around the bases.
Now, Harlem has always had a legacy of rich culture within that community. So I'm wondering, how much did you know outside of Harlem growing up in Harlem?
When I grew up in Harlem, I didn't know much of anything outside of Harlem. I didn't even know there was a rich culture in Harlem. Okay? I recognize now that, yes, there was a rich culture, but I wasn't part of it. The environment, like I was a young kid, my environment was go to school, come home, go to school, come home, go to school, come home. And eventually, as I got a little older, I played a little baseball. So we'd go to the baseball games and so forth. I had a friend, Conrad, who lived down the street from me. He was the only kid I knew who owned a bicycle. And that bicycle freed him up because he could ride all over New York from various places and get to know things. He'd come back and tell me about this and tell me about that. And it was just wonderful. I didn't know much of anything. And it wasn't until I graduated from junior. I didn't graduate from junior high school. I went to junior high school. Well, let me tell you about junior high school. And at that time, when in New York, all of the boys who lived in the same general area went to one junior high school, and all the girls in that same area went to another junior high school. So they have the girls and the boys separated out. So mind you now, I thought that there was practically a gang in every block. So what you had in this one school was a combination of a whole bunch of different gangs. And it was always a question mark who was going to get into what kind of problem, when, and where. So I survived that experience because of Stanley. Stanley was the leader of the gang on 143rd Street. And Stanley discovered that I could draw some a little bit. So Stanley had me drawing pictures of women for him, girls, you know, in various kinds of situations that I didn't know anything about, but I would go research it by looking at other stuff. And for 2 years, we didn't let anybody bother me because I was doing these images for him. And we had an art teacher for the first time, Miss Evans. Miss Evans was pretty tough. Nobody bothered her. Nobody messed with her, including Stanley. One day, Stanley had done something wrong, and she said, "Okay, Stanley, come on up here. You know what the punishment is." And he went up, and she says, "Okay, stick your hand out." He said, "Oh, Miss Evans, no, 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 no." And he said, "You know the rules." So somebody in the back started to giggle. And he looked, "Okay, sucker, after school, and so forth." And he sticks his hand out, gets a swack on his hand with his ruler, and he went back and took his seat. And at the end of the term, this is eighth grade, at the end of the term, Stanley and his warlord, Mr. Second in Command, got together and collected money from everybody in the class, as much as they could, whatever. And nobody knew what they were going to do with it for sure, but they said they were going to give Miss Evans a gift. And they did. They went out and they bought a print of an art piece. I don't remember which one, probably Renoir, somebody like that. They had a print of an art piece, presented it to Miss Evans as a gift from the class. And I was so impressed with the fact that this kid, who was an obvious leader of a gang, tough man, and so forth, had enough going that he could go out and pull this off and come back and present this thing on behalf of the class. And, anyway.
Well, in that moment, what did you pull from that moment about the value of art in that context?
Well, I didn't call anything specific about the value of art at that point, but by then I had developed a notion that art was important. It was something that I enjoyed doing. It was something that I could do relatively well. It was something that that I wanted to pursue. And combine that with the fact that Miss Evans also supported that idea, and she had selected 4 students from her class, from her 8th grade class. I was one of those 4 students, to go up to the High School of Music and Art to take the entrance exam. And if we passed that entrance exam, we could go and have the 9th grade at the High School of Music and Art. And so we'd have 4 years of high school rather than 3. That way you could have a full art program as well as all the other academic things. So the 4 of us went up to Music and Art to take the exam. We were all terrified. I was terrified particularly because we were going out of our territory. We knew we were going to get beat up. We were going to get smashed. Okay, but we went there, and for the first time in my life, this changed my life. For the first time in my life, I was going to school with people who were not all black, who were from different countries, from different nationalities, different religions, different everything. You know, girls, boys, whatever, you know. One kid came to school one day and he had a pet hamster on his shoulder. And I said, "Hey, you got a rat on your shoulder?" He said, "It's not a rat. This is my hamster, my pet." I had no idea what a hamster was. Another kid was from Lithuania. I never heard of Lithuania. I didn't know what that was, you know. But meeting people from different nationalities, different backgrounds, different experiences, they were all there at the school focused on either art or music. Everybody got along. There was no hint of gang violence. There was always some sort of harmony relationship going among all the people there. It was a wonderful experience. And I came away from that experience thinking that there's more out there in the world than what I know. I got to learn more. I would go to the museum on Sundays. By then, I was able to travel a little further. So I'd go down to the Museum of Modern Art. And I would position myself to listen to what other people were saying when they were looking at art. And all these rich folk would come in there. I say rich folk because they had on fur coats and stuff. And I figured they knew what they were talking about because they looked like they were, they were older. They looked like they knew what they were talking about. And I would listen in and see what I could learn. And I heard people standing in front of a Jackson Pollock painting talking about, "Oh, there's a bird here, and there's a this over here, and there's a that over there." And I kept looking and looking. And I said, "Oh my God, I got so much to learn. I don't see any of those things." I found out later on those things are there anyway. But it was that kind of experience that was very important to me. And after after 4 years of high school, I moved to Detroit. A whole series of circumstances. My mother was ill. She had to go move to Detroit to be closest to my oldest brother. Da, 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 da. They wanted me to come. I went. And the notion was that if I come to Detroit, I could go to Wayne State University and live there at the house and so forth. So I went to Detroit. And I, after several months, toward the end of the, well, about the time for school to start, I went down to Wayne State University and said, "Okay, here I am. I'm ready to go to school now." And they looked at me and said, "Who are you?" I said, "Larry Walker." "Where's your paperwork?" "What paperwork?" I had no transcript. I had no nothing. I had no application. None of that had been done. I said, "Well, you can't just walk in here and say you're going to go to a school and have it happen right now. And school's going to start in 2 or 3 days." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" So he says, "The only way you can get in here now is you have to take an exam." So, okay, when do I take it? So they told me when to take the exam. I took the exam and I went back and I said, "We're sorry you can't go here because you didn't pass the exam." So what do you mean I didn't pass the exam? I told all my friends I was going to go to your school and you told me I can't go now? I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what can I do?" I said, "Well, you can come back and take an exam another time, or you can go to a junior college or community college and you get a B average. You can transfer in and so on." I said, "Where's the closest one?" They pointed me to the closest one. I went to the junior college, and I said, "Okay, here I am. I'm ready for you." And Cheryl Miles was the art teacher and was my advisor. She said, okay, this is what you need to do. We sit down. She says, you take this class, this drawing class, this painting class, this English class, this art history class, this political science or whatever it was. And I said, wait a minute. This art history? I don't need that. She says, what do you mean you don't need this? I said, I had that. She says, you mean to tell me you had this art history class in high school? I said, yeah. She says, we argued back and forth. And finally, she says, all right, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the final exam for this class. If you pass it, I'll waive the class. If you don't pass it, you take it. I said, okay, fine. When do you want me to come back and take it? This is a New York arrogance. You know about New York arrogance?
A little bit.
She says, right now, put up or shut up. I said, whoa. So she gives me the exam. I go into another room. I take the exam. And we were both surprised. One, I passed it. But two, I didn't pass it with the highest grade. And she looked at me and she says, well, we can talk a little differently now because I can see that you know something about art history, but I also see that there's nothing on here about Melanesian art that you were able to tackle. I said, Melanesian art, I didn't know anything about. She says, you probably didn't have that in your class. And I said, no, we didn't. So then she convinced me that I should be in a class, I could learn more, and I could contribute, and da 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 da. So that's my start at the junior college. I was at the junior college for a year. We transferred from there to Wayne State University the next year. I graduated from Wayne State University. I eventually went back and did my master's at Wayne State University. I obtained a teaching certificate.
Met your wife while you were there also?
I met my wife. I was in school while I was, yes, I did meet her while I was there, but I didn't meet her at school. I met her in the supermarket where I worked. The supermarket where I worked was an interesting experience too, but that's another conversation.
Before we go forward
yeah.
from Wayne State back to New York,
yeah.
the high school that you transferred into,
yeah.
That eventually became LaGuardia High School.
That's true.
That's widely known as one of the best art high schools
yes.
in New York City. So yes. you were prepared once you left,
yes.
but had a little bit more refinement left for you.
Yes. Incidentally, my granddaughter just graduated from LaGuardia.
Symmetry.
Now, what were you going to say?
Well, I wanted to ask you about decisions that you made at the graduate school level, whether it was taking an arts and education route or fine art route. Because you, as many people know you, you taught art for a long time. But
yeah.
what were some of the critical decisions that you made in that context?
To answer that, I have to go back to the undergraduate days.
Okay.
When I was about 22 as an undergraduate, it occurred to me that I didn't know exactly what I was going to do with the art that I knew. So I remember sitting down one day in the stairwell by myself and raising that question, what am I going to do with this stuff? Now I know a little bit about this, a little bit about that, a little bit about that. How do I pull it together? So my solution was to take everything I knew something about and listed two categories. These are two things that are necessary. Whatever I do, it has to allow me to do what I want to do with my work. And also, whatever I do has allowed me to do something with people. So, using those criteria, I said, okay, now, given those two things, I can't pursue anything that's commercial art related. Because in commercial art, you necessarily must deal with the client. And that would not necessarily allow me to do what I want to do with my work. So anything, it was graphic design, commercial design, illustration, architecture, da, 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 out the window, gone. So by the time I finished this list, art history went out for another reason. But by the time I finished this list, the only thing that was left on the list was teaching. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. I could teach. I could do what I want to do with my work because teaching is not going to interfere with that. And I'd be working with people. So I went to the department chair and I said, I want to change my major from fine arts to art education. And he spent a half hour trying to talk me out of it. Finally, after realizing I was serious about it, he says, okay, if you must do this, I'm going to go ahead and get the paperwork started for you. But promise me one thing. He says, don't let them fill you with too much methodology. And I said, not a problem. That won't happen because I'll be able to do my work during the summer. I'll be able to do such a... I clearly didn't know what methodology meant. So I went into art education. I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Art Education. I started a teaching job. By then I was married. I got married just before I graduated. I was teaching in elementary school in Detroit. I was one of two art teachers in Pattonville Elementary School. I had fifth and sixth graders for art. The other art teacher had third and fourth graders. And the students would come to the art room two to four times a week, depending on their class. And we'd do all these art projects and on. I did that for a few years, and then eventually was transferred to another school. The other school was, I was one art teacher, and I had first grade all the way through sixth. And then I got transferred again, because I had applied for a high school and a college at the same time. The high school thing came through first, and I got transferred to high school. Anyway, in the middle of all of this, before I get into all that, in the middle of all of this, going back to your question, when I decided to go to grad school, it was after a couple of years of teaching, and the realization that if I was going to go further in teaching to get a permanent teaching certificate, I had to take some additional classes. And I said, if I'm going to take additional classes, I may as well take classes that I want to do things I want to do that will help me. And by then, I understood what methodology meant. And I said, okay, do I go art education or do I go fine arts? And clearly, it was go fine arts because methodology meant that I would have to be dealing with learning how to communicate the values of art to a whole bunch of other people. Not only students, but teachers of students. And I'd have to be involved in research and writing and da-da-da-da-da-da. So I went into fine arts for my master's. And drawing and painting was a primary area. But that was your question, how I got from, how I went from art education to fine arts. And after the experience in teaching at the high school level, the applications that I had put out for colleges, one came through that where they were interested in somebody who had taught on the elementary school level and who had a background to teach at the college level and who was focused on drawing and painting. But it was a temporary position. It was a one-year appointment, possibly two, for somebody who was going to be on leave. It was in California. So I said, okay, I'm going to go out for this interview. And what they're going to do at the school is they pay for your interview if they offer you the job. If they don't offer you the job, they're going to pay for you coming out there. If they offer you the job and you accept it, they're going to pay for it. If they offer you the job and you turn it down, I have to pay half of it. So I said to my wife, if they offer me anything close to what I'm making now, I'm taking the job because I don't want to have to pay half of it. And they offered me the job, and I accepted it, and we packed up our two kids, and we moved to California.
Talk about that change. You know, you mentioned the change from LaGrange, Georgia to New York, going from New York to Detroit, but also in this context,
yeah,
the change from Detroit to California.
Yeah, that was major. It was really major. First time on an airplane. In the airport, I met Bing Crosby for the first time, for the only time. Mm-hmm. When I got there, I was amazed that there was so much land. It's just open land, which affected my work. I started doing landscapes, you know, lots of landscapes. But it was also very open, very free, and And it felt good. It felt like a whole new land, a whole new place. It was a whole new place. And people I encountered were very much like what I anticipated or what I had experienced when I was in high school. People from different nationalities, different backgrounds, and so forth. And we were living in a small town, Stockton. Stockton was probably 60,000 when we moved there. It's much larger now. And it was the place where you got to meet people. I was one of the first two black faculty members on the campus at the University of the Pacific.
What year was this? What year was this?
1964.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting experience. But everybody there at the university was primed and ready for having faculty members of different backgrounds, different nationalities come in. And they were very helpful, they were very courteous and so forth. So we got along fine. And my work thrived. My relationship with the department was growing. And I was there for, it was supposed to be a temporary position, 1 or 2 years. I was there for 19 years. And what happened was that at the end of the second year, the teacher whose position I was replacing asked for a third year leave. And they came and asked me if I would stay a third year if necessary. And I said, well, that wasn't part of the original thing. So they went back and checked with the dean and president or whoever and decided that they would keep me whether she came back or not. And she did come back for about a year, but I stayed there. I went from a temporary visiting instructor to an assistant professor to a full professor, and eventually chaired the department for 7 years. Okay? And after 7 years chairing the department, I got out of that position, went back to doing the things I was doing, had a grant from the California Arts Council, and worked on that for a couple of years, year and a half, and was painting and exhibiting and so forth. And then I made a discovery that I really missed being chair, because while I was chair of the department, I met other people who were chairs and departments and deans of art schools, presidents of art schools, all over the country. There was an organization called the National Council of Arts Administrators, and I had become a member of that. I had become a president of that, and I missed that involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, I need to go back being a chair somewhere.
Well, delving deeper into your work during that time,
yeah,
and what California,
yeah,
allowed you to do, talk more about maybe some of the biggest changes in your work during that time.
The biggest change in my work during that time was a crystallization of landscape work. And in the landscape area, one of the things that I was also working with watercolor. I was primarily watercolor. One of the big changes that took place was that a discovery that when you're driving down the street and you're looking in your rearview mirror, you're seeing things that you just passed. So I said, that's really cool, because that sense of space, that sense of position from there to here is different. So in my work, let me see if I can capture that. So I started doing circular paintings. The circular painting was much like having the rearview mirror, the side view mirror. But the other thing that was taking place was, as I was projecting things into the space, the imagery that was there had to do with striations, land that spread out, and one hill disappeared behind another hill and behind another hill, so you had this endless depth going. But as it spread out this way, it went past the circle. So the circle became the environment in which this landscape existed, but it extended past that and into another environment. So if you consider the mat being one barrier and the circle that was drawn in, being the second one, and your lines from the landscape extending past the first and disappearing behind the second, you know, that business of space became an important area. That was extremely important for me, and it still is, because it's still part of my work. The later on, it became a situation where you drive down the street, driving down the highway particularly, and you get close enough to the back of a truck. The truck fills your entire vision, and it becomes like a barrier. It blocks your vision. You know there's space inside the truck. You know there's space beyond the truck. But right now, this thing is confronting you. And so when you have that confrontation, you become aware of the surface. Okay? And sometimes the surface has signage. It has things that have been posted on that space and so forth. Or you can kind of erode that away and see, and transcend through it, and you see images inside the vehicle, only they're still on the surface. Or you show the edge of the truck and you see beyond it. So playing with these positive and negative spaces was still an important thing. And that became, that transferred over into the circular thing. I think I showed you one. No, I didn't show you one. Another series that was called Children of Society, where the interest in figurative things became part of the circular mass. The circular space became an environment in which people existed, and there was a line going across the top. Of course, not the top, but near the top. It was like a barrier. And people were all underneath this. And they were pushing and struggling and moving around back and forth. These were mostly drawings. But this was in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. The struggle of people against this barrier was there. Eventually, the barrier bent and became kind of a parabola shape like that. And eventually, it burst through, and a figure or two figures pushed up beyond that. So this line that was there as a barrier is no longer a barrier and became kind of a cloud image. So you get a little cloud form up there, but this figure standing out in space. It's like a figure in the landscape. You saw one upstairs. Anyway. Well, those were some of the important elements that took place in the work. And then the truck series was a forerunner to the wall series.
Okay.
And you see the relationship when you move from that barrier, frontal barrier there, to a frontal barrier of the wall with posters and peeling posters and graffiti marks and so forth. And the figurative element and the interior-exterior space. And some of the figures have interior figures.
Yeah.
That's a metamorphic series. And the metamorphic series also was part of the landscape series at one time, because it had these things that looked like shoulders, but they were really heads and so forth of people. I didn't show you any of those, but there's some in there.
Yeah. I want to see those. Well,
I'll show you one.
Okay. In the 60s.
60s.
There's a lot of change happening in the country.
Oh, yeah. Lots.
How did you place yourself in the context of what was happening in the country in that time frame?
I consider myself part of the change, although I was not actively in the places where the change was most prominent. Mm-hmm. But there was change taking place on the campus at the University of the Pacific. And one of the changes was the fact that during that time period, there was a push to get more ethnicity among the student group. And the way in which that came about, or the way in which it happened, was a lot of discussion and a lot of protests and so forth. But eventually, what was created was a program that was open, that was focused on the community, that would enable African American students to come to the university, if they qualified to come to the university, to come in and to be supported by this program in terms of the kinds of things that were set up. Tutoring programs, mentoring programs, jobs here and there, reduction of, actually elimination of tuition, things of that nature. And they had a person who was in charge of that program who was African-American. In fact, I was on the committee that selected that person. And he came in, in fact, interesting guy. I don't know if he's still around, but he stayed at the university for a number of years as director of that program, and he eventually moved to Atlanta and took a position at International Theological Seminary. And I think he's retired from that, but I don't know if he's still alive. I haven't seen him for a long time. His name was John Diamond. Anyway, there was that focus and helping students, helping organize situations where they could move ahead. And some of that filtered over into the community as well, because there was a lot of community interest in Stockton for promoting blackness, so to speak. Yeah. And then in my work, that was the time period when the Children's Society series was most prominent and was focused around the idea of people struggling and so forth. That answered your question a little bit.
You got there.
Okay.
You got there. The transition to come back to the East or the Southeast to take on the position at Georgia State, when did that position present itself to you? And what were you thinking when it was time to make that move?
After my 7 years of chair at University of the Pacific, and then missing the kind of activities that I had experienced while I was chair, and feeling the need to get back into the swing of things, and I made the decision that I would put my feelers out there, see what else was there, instead of waiting to try to go back in at UOP. So after 19 years, here I was, a tenured full professor, 19 years experience, and I leave to go to Georgia State University because they made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
In all of those transitions, what I haven't heard you talk about is, well, somewhat, but the conversation with family in terms of making those changes to move from one place to another. You were married. You mentioned you and your wife got married when you were still in Detroit.
Yeah.
Whenever there was a chance for you to move or to make a life-changing decision, what were some of those conversations like with her in terms of making those types of moves that really impacted not just you but everyone else?
Yeah. My wife has always been very supportive with the moves. The move to California, she was very supportive of, because it represented a new space, a new everything. And it was not easy once we did it, but it was good. And the move from California to Georgia, that was a situation where we discussed the possibility of the move. I had come out for an interview and had no idea how things went, and went back to California to continue doing what I was doing. And I figured that was it. They're not interested. So after a few weeks, I got another call and they asked me to come back for another interview and to bring my wife. And I'm saying to myself, bring my wife? Why do they want to interview my wife? They're not hiring her, they're hiring me. In the long run, it turned out to be very good because we both came out for that, and so she had a chance to see the campus, see the space, and get a feel for what people were like and so forth, and the fact that the offer was more than half of what I was making. Okay? And it was one of those offers you couldn't refuse. So we came, and I remember saying to her, you know, suppose this doesn't work out. Suppose I get there and then I blow it. She says, well, if that happens, if they don't want you or you don't want to be here, then we go somewhere else. And I thought that was just wonderful, you know, to have that kind of support. We'll go somewhere else. We'll do something else. Whatever you want to do that makes sense, let's go do it. There was more of an effect on my youngest. By this time, we had three kids. Our youngest was Kara, and she was 13. Dana was the oldest. Dana was at USC. In fact, she had just finished USC, if I remember correctly. Well, anyway, she was in California, and she'd made this decision that, you know, that's California's going to be her home. Finished school, she was going to stay in the Los Angeles area. You're going to Georgia? Fine. See ya. Our son, who had started UOP as a student and had bombed out, had dropped out, and was floating around taking class here and there at the community college, he decided to come with us because it would be a new opportunity for him to get his feet wet, get start over again, and so forth. So we all came to, the three of us, the four of us, my wife and two kids, came to Georgia. And the first year was interesting, in Decatur. And then we moved into to Stone Mountain. Then in 1984. We moved into Stone Mountain and to a neighborhood that was just beginning to change a little bit, very little, because we used to get announcements on the mailbox to come to Klan meetings.
Wow.
And I said, first one that was on there, I came in and said, hey wife, I'm going to go to this Klan meeting, we've been invited. She says, no way, I'm going to the Klan meeting. Anyway, interesting experiences.
When you first got here, in terms of the arts community, what are some of your earlier recollections of what was happening here as far as the local artists?
Well, before I got here, my notion was that the Atlanta area was a bigger, more it was a bigger environment for art, and there would be greater opportunities to show my work, have my work become part of collections and so forth, much more so than in Stockton. Stockton was kind of like nowhere. If you lived in Stockton, from an art perspective, you didn't exist, unless you had work in San Francisco or Los Angeles and somewhere other than Stockton. The work that was in Stockton, while it may have been good and may have been seen by people in Stockton, it wasn't seen by people in San Francisco or Los Angeles as being significant. Okay? Here, I figured, okay, in Atlanta's a bigger city, there's going to be greater opportunities. But what I discovered when I get here, after some point in time, was that there's similar concerns. Whatever happens in Atlanta seemed to be good for it in Atlanta, but wasn't recognized in New York. It wasn't recognized in Los Angeles. Wasn't recognized in this other place, in Chicago. I mean, Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles are the art meccas. And if they're not interested in what's happening in Atlanta, and people in Atlanta are going to New York to buy art, or going to Chicago to buy art, not buying in Atlanta, then something's wrong. And it was that was kind of the feeling early on. And it's some of that's still around. Some of that attitude is still around. New York and Los Angeles and Chicago have opened up a little bit. They are now much more receptive to artists from elsewhere. You don't necessarily have to live in New York in order to make it in New York or to make it anywhere else. You can have your studio in Waco, Texas, and show in New York, and it's still okay. Mm. Now, it didn't used to be. In the Atlanta scene was complicated by a couple of things. The High Museum, which was the biggest art venue in the area, biggest and perhaps best known art venue in the area, didn't seem to have much interest in art in Atlanta, artists in Atlanta. It focused its attention on blockbuster kind of exhibitions from France and X number of other places. And they were trying to grow their reputation as being a major museum and not a community-oriented museum. And that was detrimental, I think, for the community. And the things that were helping in the Atlanta area were things like the Atlanta Contemporary Art Center, and later on, the Museum of Contemporary Art of Atlanta, and at one point, Hammond's House Museum, all played a role in providing an opportunity for artists in the area to show their work, to have their work recognized by critics and curators and so forth. But it was still limited because some of those curators were focused only in Atlanta and they didn't have any roots outside of any consequence. And at this point in time, it's still a struggle because Atlanta doesn't have a major critic. Excuse me. The newspaper. Mm-hmm. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution does not have a major art critic. They have a person who does what they can do by focusing in on those popular kind of exhibits that people would be interested in most people would be interested in, but hardcore work is not quite there. When the art critic they had, they reduced their emphasis on the art critic, and she ultimately went, and this is Kathy Fox, she ultimately went on and became she created her own blog and then I guess it was called a blog. It was called Arts Atlanta. And she was still writing and doing critiques and engaging other critics to write things. And that was helpful. But it still is helpful, but it's the people who read the newspaper weren't getting what was needed. The museum, the High Museum, has adjusted its focus now. But that's only been in the last few years. They hired a curator who came in with a different mindset. He was interested in the community. And I guess they told him that that's what they wanted him to do, come in and engage the community and get the community more involved. So he's been very helpful in that regard, going to art exhibits in various places and seeing what artists do and going to visit studios and talking to people that's been very helpful. Plus, there have been more and more organizations that have popped up in the Atlanta area that are helping younger artists to grow and thrive and so forth. The Museum of Contemporary Art of Georgia has a program they call the Working Artist Program, where they select someone, they select three people a year to do artwork. And they provide a stipend and artist assistants. And so forth. And your own organization, Wonder Rig, they have a program that's working very well too. And, things are growing and things are ebbing. Hammond's House has had some difficulties and hopefully they'll come back again. But I think in the long run, art in Atlanta is probably better off than it was 10 years ago. But it still has another few years to go before it comes close to being a major venue.
As an artist, as an African-American artist, when you hear or see the phrase black art and how your work may fall in that or not in that, talk about that.
Talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could, I am black.
Right.
One could say that the work that I do has references to the black community or not. The thing that's a little discouraging is that the term black art, when it first came about, it came about because of expediency. And it was like, it was recognition, it was to demonstrate that there were artists of color who were out there doing stuff and shouldn't be dismissed. That was the primary reason for introducing the word black art. But when it was introduced with a lot of controversy, and the arts community, the larger arts community, raised questions like, what is black art? How do you define it from other art? What are the distinct characteristics of it that make it black art rather than art? So people going around, you know, artists and art historians and critics and so on, running around trying to come up with a way to define this, a way to respond to those issues. And finally, someone says, wait a minute, that's not our problem. The artist said this. This is not our problem. Our problem is to create art. Let somebody else resolve this question of whether it's black art or not. You know, there were some artists who rejected the idea of black art in general, would not show their work in an exhibition if the exhibition was titled Black Art, okay, because they felt it was limiting. In many ways, it was limiting. In fact, there was an article in last Sunday's New York Times talking about the fact that there were so many African-American artists who had not been adequately recognized for the nature of their work. And part of the concern was the fact that at one point there was an emphasis on black art, and museums were clamoring to get some black art in their collections so that they could say to the world, hey, we have black art in our work, in our collection. And in the process, they missed some artists. I'm one of them who got missed, in my opinion, okay? at any rate, what was I talking about?
Well,
I got it.
to follow up on that, I've had a chance to talk to a few artists here and there, and yeah. I think a lot of artists who have a different set of influences currently.
Yeah.
And in their work, those influences, well, let's just say, if you saw their work, you couldn't tell that the work was by a black artist or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that there's a certain amount of expectation on black artists.
Yeah.
To create work that looks like it was done by someone who was black.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And that's the point I wanted to get to. Over a period of time, the term black art coalesced to a point where it meant that the work had to take on certain specific characteristics of blackness. You know, family, religion, you know. It had to be something specific in there that black people could relate to directly, that was related to their life. And there was a bunch of artists out there who weren't doing that and didn't feel the need to do that. They felt the need to do some other things. And when you have a term like black art that eliminates some black artists, that's awkward, okay? When you could start naming a bunch of artists who didn't fall into those categories at all. And if they weren't considered in the art world, and they weren't considered in the black art world, where were they? They were just left out there in the open. So there needed to be another kind of definition of what black art was, or there needed to be the elimination of black art and the acceptance of art in general done by black people. Okay?
All right.
Which I think is probably the more appropriate thing to do. In fact, there was a big argument among museums. Museums, for a while, didn't know whether to put up a label in there in the museum saying, like, this is a black art gallery. Then put all the black art in that gallery. And some other museums said, no, you can't do that. You can't put up a sign that says black art gallery. You go put up another sign that says white art gallery? No. Finally, they got away from that and then there was the other issue of labels. A label that said the name of the artist, or said African-American artist so-and-so-and-so. Okay? And they weren't saying that on other artists, like white artist so-and-so-and-so. So they started backing off that too. So in order to identify that a person is black, there needed to be some other kind of statement if you needed to do it at all. And so narrative labels became important in museums. So a museum might have a narrative label that somewhere in the label would suggest that the nature of what this person was black or Hispanic or whatever. But it didn't necessarily have to show up in the title. It didn't have to show up, in front of the person's name and so forth. And certainly not on the gallery name saying this is Hispanic work.
You mentioned earlier that your father died when you were very young.
Yeah.
And you yourself are a very proud father. Can you talk about maybe how that notion of your father still influences you or influences or maybe shows up in your work?
I think so. Back in California, I had a studio at one point that was it was away from home. It was on the campus at the University of Pacific. And I would go over to the studio and work. It was in the desolate part of the campus. Nobody around, empty building. And I would work over there sometimes on Sunday. So I was in there one Sunday morning and I was doing a painting. And I kept wondering why in these abstracted paintings there was always this little figure that showed up. You know. And I couldn't figure out where this figure came from. At one point I thought it was an influence from some artist, but it wasn't really that. And then all of a sudden, one Sunday morning, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Boom. This is me searching for my father. And I sat there looking at this painting. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense that I keep putting this figure in there because I really didn't know my father and I needed to. I sat there in tears for quite a while. Then I went home and told my wife about it. And ever since then, after I resolved that issue, ever since then, it was perfectly legitimate for me to put a figure in there in an abstracted painting. Didn't have anything to do with the painting. Mm-hmm. It was legitimate to put that figure in there. It was all right. Not a problem at all. And that figure has been floating around in there. It's been changed over the years. Sometimes that figure became a shadow. Okay? Sometimes that shadow became me. Sometimes the shadow became something else. But the figurative element grew out of the recognition that I was in search of my father. Okay?
All right.
That's about the only influence in that regard that I can think of.
Last question as we wrap up. When are you most inspired as an artist?
When? Ooh, that's a hard one. I think I get most inspired when I'm in the process of doing it. I start doing a piece and something triggers off in the work that says, hey, this is a good idea. This is great. This is an interesting possibility and so forth. And I get fired up about that. And I pursue that particular thing. So the most inspiring time is in the process of doing it. Not leading up to it, but in the process of doing it. I've talked to a lot of people who say, you know, I can't get inspired to do anything. Or da, 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 I don't. How do you get inspired to do anything? Or how do you get, what influences this and what influences that? And for me, it's a matter of doing it. Just do something. Start. Even if it's not something you want to do. Pick up a pencil, draw. Whenever I get in a funk or situation where things seem to be kind of closing in, drawing is a key. Start drawing. Even draw anything. Draw an iron, draw a pencil, draw whatever. The minute you start drawing, at some point you're going to discover that you really don't need to be drawing that particular thing. There's something else that gets triggered off from that, and it kind of snowballs. So once you're in the spirit of working, the inspiration grows out of that context. That help?
It does help. But I lied. That is not the last question.
Oh my God.
One last question.
Okay.
And I ask this now after having spent some time with you and walking around and seeing your collection. And you mentioned earlier how you felt like maybe you were overlooked earlier in your career, or at least when people were starting to recognize artists. And I'm wondering, how would you like to be remembered?
How would I like to be remembered?
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned earlier that I'm having my work archived now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a lot of it around. I would like the work itself to be out there someplace so that other people, other artists, can see it and maybe learn from it. I think there's some things that I've done in my work that might inspire somebody to do something else, or might encourage somebody to try something different. So I would like really to have the work in some situation where it can be seen with the idea of providing some educational experience for somebody. I haven't quite figured out exactly how that can happen. You know, it'd be nice if there was a, one thought has been if there was to have a foundation. And the foundation can coordinate the work so that it can go to this place or that place and ultimately get donated to appropriate museums and so forth that would have an interest in the ability to take care of it. I'm not too particular in having the work go to an institution that does not have the means to take care of it. Like if I donated something to a school, and the school doesn't have a museum, they don't really have the means to take care of the work adequately in terms of keeping track of it, caring for it, making the necessary changes and so forth. So unless they have a museum program, I don't think it's going to happen. But a museum would have that. Okay.
Larry Walker, thank you for your time.
You're quite welcome.